But what we need is for QA folks to kind of raise their gaze up from just building and running tests and think about the larger perspective, take a more systems thinking view of the whole thing. Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation related. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. And today we're going to be speaking with Jeff Susna, author of the book, Designing Delivery, Rethinking IT and the Digital Service Economy. But first, let's hear it for our awesome sponsor, Sauce Labs. Today's episode is sponsored by Sauce Labs. Sauce Labs makes test automation awesome. Sauce's cloud-based Selenium Grid helps developers test web and mobile apps across more than 400 browser and OS platforms. Sauce also supports Appium and popular JavaScript unit testing frameworks and integrates with all the top programming languages, test frameworks, and CI systems. With built-in video recording, debugging tools, and secure tunneling for firewall testing, Sauce helps you ship better software faster. Sign up at saucelabs.com with promo code TESTTALKS14 and get 20 hours of automated testing for free. So my question today is, do you think QA is dead? If you've been in any meetings with some agile managers or managers in general, you may hear comments like, what do we need QA for? What do we need testers for? It's really ignorant comments you sometimes hear. So you might be surprised by the answer. Today, Jeff shares with us his view on cybernetics and the 21st century IT and what happens to QA in a DevOps world. His book covers how service quality is not just about designing capabilities, but about making and keeping promises to customers. In this episode, you'll hear how to make IT a full partner in the ongoing conversations you have with your customers and why QA is an important part of this transformation. So listen up and discover how QA is even more important than ever before and how QA test engineers will actually thrive in the years to come. Check it out. Hey, Jeff, welcome to Test Talks.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So before we get into it, could you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
I'm an independent IT consultant, and I specialize in helping companies adopt 21st century IT. I've been in the industry for 30 years now, believe it or not. And my career is a little unique in that I've built a lot of systems, and I've also held leadership positions across the entire development, QA, and operations spectrum. What's particularly interesting about me is I have a liberal arts background, and I've been influenced throughout my career by design and design thinking, and all of my work is around really trying to unify design and engineering.
So, Jeff, I think that liberal arts degree really shines through in your new book, Designing Delivery, Rethinking IT and the Digital Service Economy. Why did you write Designing Delivery?
I think to some degree it was a way to take that sort of long, quixotic quest to bring design and engineering together. In particular, I'd been doing a series of talks on the DevOps circuit about cybernetics and 21st century IT and what happens to QA in a DevOps world and promise theory, and they all started coming together in my mind. And what I really wanted to do was communicate something about the importance of thinking about service and digital business as a whole and thinking about IT as an integral part of that business, and also to talk about some ways to actually accomplish it.
So what I really love about your book is that you cover a lot of things that most people do not find in most development QA DevOps books, like cybernetics. So before we jump into what happens to QA in a DevOps world, what do you mean by cybernetics? And how does it relate to QA, I guess?
Sure. So cybernetics is a somewhat lost discipline that actually came out of the 1940s. And was behind a lot of the work that went into the original definition of what computing even meant and what information theory even meant. And the basic principle is that complex systems, whether it be people or organizations or economies, interact with their environments through feedback mechanisms, which gives them the ability to adapt to their environment. And, you know, feedback is a term, it's central to cybernetics. The word cybernetics comes from a Greek word that means steersman or steering. And if you think about steering a car or piloting a boat, you can't just point yourself in a direction and go. You have to have the ability to respond to, you know, things like currents and winds that you don't expect and kind of continually bring yourself back on track. And if you think about the nature of business in the 21st century, where we hear a lot of talk about the need to innovate and disruption and, you know, blue chip companies going out of business more and more quickly, it's no longer enough to say, well, we make Band-Aids and we make the best Band-Aids in the world and we've made them for 100 years and let's keep making Band-Aids better and better. And one of the characteristics of post-industrialism is the need to shift your focus as a company from doing the same thing over and over again to doing new things on a continuous basis. So in order to do new things and in order to know whether those new things are relevant, you need some kind of feedback mechanism. And that's basically the cybernetic approach to things.
Later on in later chapters, you start getting into quality and a quality mindset. And basically, I've noticed with more teams going towards Agile that they almost discount QA as if it's just a function within a sprint team that anyone could play that role as a QA person. But it almost sounds like you're saying this isn't the way it's going to be in the future or the way it should be. It's the feedback that QA builds into the process that continually questions and brings in more information based on a user's perspective. Can you talk a little bit more about that piece?
Sure. First, I think you hit the nail on the head that QA is really the representative for feedback. You know, the technical definition of feedback is that you measure the gap between what you expected and what you actually got. And that's exactly what QA is. You know, we hear people saying things like, well, QA is a bad name because we can't actually assure anything. All we can do is provide information. That's actually where the theory of information came from in the 1940s was, if you're going to measure this gap between where you are and where you want to be, you need some information in order to measure it. And that's really the job of QA, is to provide that information. So on the one hand, it's a really precious part of the process. On the other hand, what we've seen historically is, you know, with kind of a waterfall model where, you know, you build something for 6 months and then you integration test it for 3 months, that feedback process is very far away and your ability to steer is very, very slow. And, you know, if you're piloting your boat and you respond to wind and currents very slowly, you get thrown very far off course, and correcting yourself is very difficult and slow and painful. And I think part of why there's been this traditional adversarial relationship between development and QA is, if QA is coming back and saying, okay, over the last 6 months, here's 5,000 mistakes you made, your software is really terrible, that doesn't make anybody happy. On the other hand, if QA is saying, here's the 3 mistakes you made today, it's much easier to respond to, and that in and of itself makes the relationship healthier between development and QA. In my experience, I've seen quality skyrocket when organizations make QA and development much more intimate. I haven't seen it skyrocket when they get rid of QA altogether. And I think there's a misunderstanding. You know, if we're shipping every 2 weeks, obviously we can't have a QA department that takes 3 weeks in order to do testing. That doesn't mean we don't need a QA department. It means we need the cycle between writing the code and testing the code to be a matter of minutes or hours instead of days or weeks.
Awesome. And you actually have a great quote. I'll probably have to edit this in, but you talk about both developers and testers both testing at the same time at the beginning of a sprint to find out issues before they start coding, I think. It was something along those lines.
Yeah, and it's funny because one of the things that I see all too often in sprint planning is everybody gets together and they figure out all of the development tasks that are going to happen during the sprint. And the testers sit in the back of the room and nobody thinks about the testing tasks. Mm-hmm. Where what you really want to be doing is saying, okay, here's a feature we want to build. And there's, you know, we think there's 9 hours of development and we think there's 3 hours of writing the tests and doing the tests. And great, now the developer and the tester are going to go work on it together over the next half day or day or day and a half.
I definitely agree with that approach. I also believe in developers baking like testability into their development code so that later on when you do need to automate it, because once you go to continuous integration and continuous deployment, you're going to need this test, a lot of these tests to be automated. So they need to be automatable. And I think if you start that at the beginning of the sprint thinking, the developer is thinking, like, how can I make this code automatable? You'll save a lot of time later on once the code is finished, and then you have to go ahead and test it and plug it into your CI systems.
Couldn't agree more. And few things drive me nuts more than the whole idea of, well, let's test this code, and then after the end of the sprint, we'll figure out how to automate the tests.
Absolutely.
That's pretty much a guarantee that your testing process will fall farther and farther behind. And the interesting thing is, if you have good automation tools, you can actually start by writing automated tests from the very beginning.
What kind of tools would you recommend for that type of approach? I know we use behavior-driven development, and we use it for the collaboration piece, but you can also make that into executable specifications later on. I found that a big help to just help communicate from the beginning about what the requirements are, how we think they are, and talking about them, and then being able to automate them later on once we've hashed out all those bugs before we've even written any code.
I'm a big fan of BDD. The one tool that I tell everybody to use is something called Vagrant, which you can think of it as the ability to have a mini cloud on your desktop. The thing that's great about Vagrant is it allows you to very easily build and run local environments that are a very good match for production. And it means that everybody can be writing code, testing code, even product managers doing user acceptance testing and prototype review, all on their desktops, all up front. You don't have to wait until you get into some big test environment or acceptance environment or, God forbid, production. That if I'm the developer and I'm writing code and I'm the tester and I'm writing tests at the beginning of the sprint, we can be doing all of that on environments that are like each other and like production. And if there's one thing that I see that actually starts getting people thinking about the same things in the same ways, it's really Vagrant.
Awesome. I've actually never heard of Vagrant. I'm definitely going to check it out because this sounds like a tool that will definitely help us out. So also in the book, you talk about testing and production. Is that a practice you see happening more and more as people start shifting left and trying to code and develop as soon as possible and bake in quality to actually best results are actually testing in your actual production environment?
You know, one thing I like to do when I give presentations, I have a t-shirt that says I don't always test my code, but when I do it in production. And I love to wear that t-shirt because it just wakes everybody up. And yes, it is true that more testing happens in production. It's important to understand that that doesn't mean that less testing happens before production. What it means is that as we build more and more complex digital systems, and we go to cloud and systems break down into microservices and they get more scalable, and we start having relationships between systems of engagement and systems of record, we start to shift from this world of so-called complicated systems, which are like a car. They have a lot of moving parts, but you can understand all of the relationships, more towards complex systems, which are more like flocks of birds or economies where you have these very fluid shifting relationships. The problem with complex systems is you can't actually model them very well, and you can't know in advance how they're going to behave. And they're very resilient, but they're also very sloppy. They have a lot of failure, and you can't avoid that failure. You know, from a certain perspective, the whole idea behind testing is let's avoid failures in production. With complex systems, you kind of can't. And what that means is that you have to start doing failure discovery to some degree in your production environments. And we can even see this at the business level. If you think of something like A/B testing, which is the idea that you have two ideas for what might be a good new user interface, and so you try them both with real users. What you're saying there is, well, we don't really know what the right answer is. So we're going to put something out that might be worse, and we're going to find out. We're going to get feedback from our users as to whether it's worse or whether it's better. It used to be that we would think, well, that's a really dumb idea, right? Is don't release until you know that it's right. But more and more in the current economy, in the current, you know, online world, you can't know that. So you have no choice. but to start testing both at the business level and the technical level in production. So what I like to say is that quality moves both left and right, and it becomes continuous. And what I mean by that is, on the one hand, we need to do more testing up front. And some of that is having testers develop, pair with developers and test at the beginning of the sprint. Some of that is using things like BDD to capture requirements bugs at the very beginning of the process. But then some of it is all the way at the other end when you get into production, you really have to keep testing.
So it almost sounds like it's a continuous feedback loop. Everything is getting feedback and then going back into the system and maybe modifying based on that feedback. So it's a continuous process almost. There's nothing really set in stone, thou shall almost. It's based on what the user's saying, what you've done, how you can modify it, make it better, and then getting user feedback again. Is that what the whole design delivery kind of flow would be like?
That is exactly right. And the basic principle is, if you are trying to operate in a business in the world, in a world that's changing more and more quickly, and that's harder and harder to know, then you have no choice but to basically test all the time. So in some sense, you're always designing, in that you're continually changing your system. You're always operating, in that everything you do, you know, if you're doing continuous delivery, which means that you are delivering code changes on a continuous basis, suddenly it means that your software development lifecycle is actually part of operations in a strange way. And then finally, because you're continually processing feedback everywhere, you're continuously testing. So yes, it all becomes this continuous feedback loop, which is exactly why I started off the book by presenting this basic concept of cybernetics, because that circularity and steering through feedback starts to guide everything we do as a business and everything we do as an IT organization.
Awesome. So do these concepts that you lay out also apply to large companies that may be heavily regulated, or is it just for more nimble, small companies? And the reason why I ask, I work for a large company that, you know, we can be audited by the FDA. So a lot of times they say things do have to be black and white and they do have to have requirements. But at the same time, we're trying to be agile and create things and quality early on in the process. So how do we juggle these two kind of almost opposing views?
First of all, I think, yes, it very much applies to large organizations. And it applies to them in a couple of ways. One is, when you look at the things you need in order to become continuous, such as automating testing, automating infrastructure provisioning, all of that automation makes auditing much, much easier. If you can guarantee that the only reason code gets changed in production is because some audited system with logging put it there, then you know you can always say who made this change and why and when. Secondly, the way that you have to do this, and this comes out of the lean world, the way to go faster without sacrificing quality is to reduce batch sizes, which simply means you do things in much smaller chunks, which is really at the heart of Agile, of instead of building something that's based on 3 months worth of work, we're going to build something that's based on 3 weeks or 3 days or 3 hours of work. It is much easier to manage those small things. And what that means is that the overhead you have is actually much easier to manage. So there's no reason why you can't have requirements and traceability for everything. If you're doing them in small units, that overhead is now much smaller. And so you can satisfy both masters at the same time.
So I think the complete opposite of FDA and being regulated and having all these requirements is also chaos. You know, we live in chaos, we develop in chaos. A lot of us pretend like we don't, but we do. So how can we use chaos to our benefit? I think in your book, you have actually an example of Netflix and how they have chaos built into what they have, what they're calling a chaos monkey. Can you tell us a little bit about that approach?
And the chaos monkey comes out of an observation by Adrian Cockcroft, who used to be the chief cloud architect at Netflix and is sort of the brains behind their whole cloud-based approach. And he likes to say, when you have speed at scale, everything breaks, right? If you're making a lot of changes and you have a lot of moving pieces, something's going to break somewhere all the time. So they started shifting their approach away from trying to engineer out failure and instead to engineer in the ability to find failure. Because if you know it's out there and you go and find it, you're actually better off because now it's not a mystery. So they came up with a tool called the Chaos Monkey. And basically what it is it's an automated system that goes out into production systems during the day and intentionally breaks things. So let's say, for example, you have a replicated database. It will intentionally turn off one of the databases in the cluster. You know, it will just go around and sort of start shutting things down. The intention is, if you've designed your system, quote unquote, properly, you won't care, because you'll have this nice resilient architecture, and the fact that one half of the database cluster is down or one node out of a load balanced set of web servers is down, you won't care. What happens is that sometimes you do care because you make mistakes and the Chaos Monkey finds them. And the good news is it finds them during the day when the engineers are awake and fresh and expecting things, as opposed to finding them at 3 o'clock in the morning when everybody's asleep. So this is really an example of taking testing. When you think about it, it's testing, right? Let's try and break the system. The really interesting thing that Adrian said to me is that they don't consider it a success when the Chaos Monkey finds no problems. They consider it a success, and the testers listening should really like this. They consider it a success when the Chaos Monkey does find problems. And again, it's because now they know more than they used to. Now they've learned something.
Now, that's a great point. Even in general, when you're doing automated testing, if you're not finding problems, that's probably an issue. If you have a set of tests that run every year, and you're like, yeah, we have thousands of tests, but they never fail. You know, they never catch a failure. That's probably a problem in your design, I would think. It's almost feedback that you're getting. It's telling you something's not right. So, Jeff, you bring up some other concepts that you probably may not think about when you think about designing software. One of them is empathy. How does empathy play into this continuous new designing delivery kind of mindset?
It plays in at every single level. So the starting point is that one of the properties of this post-industrial world is that the relationship between producers and consumers is really changing. And the consumer is sort of wresting control away and wresting control of the marketing message away from producers. If I can go on Twitter and complain to the whole world about your software instead of calling your customer support line, the equation between us has really changed. And that, plus the growing importance of design, when we have things like smart refrigerators and smart thermostats and so on and so forth, is really driving companies to be much more user-centered in their approach to their customers. And user-centered design really starts from empathy of, you know, it's not about me figuring out the correct way to sit in a chair. If I'm a chair designer, I need to understand who you are and how you experience a chair and what makes you comfortable. So it's all about starting to see things from the other's perspective. This trickles all the way down to everything we do. Really, where I started talking about empathy was in the context of DevOps, that we have this historically dysfunctional adversarial relationship between development and operations. Development thinks, well, ops is too slow, and they're always telling us no, and why the heck does it take 3 months to tip up a server? On the other hand, operations is saying, well, these developers are a bunch of hacks, and their software never works, and we can never install it, and they just throw it at us every 20 minutes. And the starting point to heal that relationship is, well, if I'm a developer, how does operations experience me throwing my software over the wall? If I'm an operations person, what does it do to development when I'm always saying no? I may have perfectly valid reasons, but what does it do to them and what could I change based on that? Similar between development and QA. And again, one of the best ways to improve that I see, both between dev and QA and dev and ops, is to bring people closer together and have them work together. It's funny, when folks first started talking about DevOps and how we have to get developers and operations working together and going out to lunch together and sitting next to each other, my first thought was, well, we did that with Dev and QA 20 years ago, right? When we started, I mean, I was at Apple in the late 80s when they blew up their 250-person QA organization and embedded the testers into the dev organization. So you'd have a development team of five people with one or two testers, and they all sat next to each other and they all went out to lunch together. And guess what? Quality skyrocketed overnight. And part of what happens when you do that is that people start empathizing with each other. And when people do that, the boundaries between them that create friction and that impede quality start to dissolve.
It's a good point you make, because a lot of times you may be part of a team that may have an internal service that you're offering. So your customer is not traditional users of your application, but they may be an organization within your company. And that if you have the empathy towards them, what they're looking for, you probably would create a better service for them overall.
Absolutely. And part of what I try and communicate in my book is that everything we do is service. So even if you have a separate IT department, or you have a separate design department, or a separate QA department, you're all in the business of providing service to each other, just like your company provides service to your customers. And the whole point of service is to help somebody and to help them accomplish their goals. And if we take that perspective, rather than I do this thing, I make this thing, if we take the perspective of how do I use what I do to help you, that's a starting point towards empathizing and providing better service.
Awesome. You actually have a nice quote in the book, and it's, customers judge service quality based on the entirety of their experience. So I think that's pretty powerful, because no longer is it just a feature of your application, but it's the whole entirety of it. And I think you give an example of healthcare.gov as an example of the first time that, you know, I forgot what you said, but this was based on a website instead of an actual product, a physical product.
Yeah. What I was saying is, it's funny because we all think of healthcare.gov as a website. The people who built it thought of it as a series of government IT projects. And they were used to a world where nobody outside of the Beltway saw or cared about government IT projects. So they weren't, nobody made the connection. When you think about it, at least early on, so much of the angst about the Affordable Care Act was focused on the website. And it never occurred to anyone that we would really think about this huge, important, contentious law that has a lot of emotional impact on all of us because it concerns our health, that would be connected to a website. And it was connected to a website because the website had security problems and performance problems and scalability problems. So all of a sudden you had this connection between ops and my emotional life. And I was judging the website, I was judging the government, I was judging the president, all based on that experience.
Wow. Yeah, when you think about it, like you said, you're almost taking your frustrations out on the website. So So this example also makes me think once again of service. I know we touched upon it a little bit. So can you talk a little bit more about why service is so important and why you really focus on it within your book?
You know, we all tend, and this is an area where I think QA can play a really important role. We all instinctively focus on the things that we make. But the reason that somebody, you know, I'll give an example. I'm an independent consultant, so invoicing is really important to me. So I use an online invoicing service. But the reason I use it is not because I want to create invoices. It's because I want to get paid on time, right? I have some goal, something that I need to accomplish that's important to me, and I need help with it. So in essence, I hire this invoicing service to help me. And this is a new service economy, 21st century approach to value. And what I'm trying to communicate in my book, really at the heart, is that at all levels, whether we're a microservice team or we're a QA engineer or we're a company, is we need to kind of flip our minds 180 degrees away from thinking about what is the quality of the thing I'm making, which isn't to say we shouldn't care about, but the essence is not how good is the thing I made. The essence is how well can my customer use it to do what they want to do. And personally, I think that QA can play a great role in helping organizations remember that by, okay, it doesn't matter how good it is. If I write a test, or if I even just think about, okay, how does this help or not help my customer do their job? Then I can help improve quality.
Awesome. Great point. So Jeff, I also thought of another, something just jumped in my head as you were speaking also. and you address this in the book, there's been a shift in QA to call, because every time we've spoken so far, you've mentioned the term QA, and it's almost a derogatory term now for some reason, with QA people calling themselves testers instead of QA engineers. But you make up a good point of why you think QA in the title is important. Can you just speak to that really quickly?
Sure. On the one hand, I understand the concern with the term quality assurance, because as we discussed earlier, testers can't assure anything. Mm-hmm. It's not their job to assure that the product or service is quality. All they can do is provide information that helps with that. The reason I'm not a fan of the term tester is it feels a little too mechanical to me. You know, my job is to test. I've been playing around with sort of a pun on QA, which is quality advocacy, because I think ultimately the sort of most profound role of call them QA people, call them testers, whatever you want, is to advocate for this service-oriented understanding of quality. And, you know, are we helping our customers and are we responding to feedback?
That's a great point. And like we said earlier on, that a lot of people, when they go agile, they think, we don't need QA anymore. But it almost sounds like in this new world, when we're trying to really create design delivery, that QA is essential for this process.
It is essential, but what we need is for QA folks to kind of raise their gaze up from just building and running tests, mm-hmm. and think about the larger perspective, take a more systems thinking view of the whole thing.
That's another good point. You actually address this in the book also. Complexity forces QA thinking into system thinking.
Absolutely. Again, I think DevOps drives this in a simple way, in that we can no longer just think about functional testing when we're testing. We need to think about distributed systems and systems failures and integration with third-party systems and so on and so forth.
Okay, Jeff, before we go, is there one piece of actual advice you can give someone to improve the designing delivery efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
I think the one piece of advice would be to really focus on communicating across boundaries as much as possible. So if you're a QA person, talk to the ops folks, talk to the InfoSec folks, talk to the design folks, and really just continually try and expand your scope of who you're talking to and what you're thinking about. And key to that, and this goes back to the whole thing about cybernetics and feedback loops, is when I say talk to, that actually was a bad word. What I really should say is have conversations with. And the reason I say that is because in order for a conversation to be useful, both parties have to listen. And as much as anything, what I'm trying to say with the book is that business is more and more about listening and less about talking. And we need, in order to empathize, we have to listen to each other. So I think that what I would say is really find opportunities to listen to more and more parts of the organization. If folks want to find me, you can find me on my website, which is engineering.it. It's spelled just like engineering, except with an I at the beginning. You can find my blog there too, blog.engineering.it. But really the best place to find me is on Twitter at Jeff Susna.
Thank you, Jeff, for your DevOps QA awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/68. And while you're there, make sure to click on the More Info link under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. Also, make sure to subscribe, rate, and review Test Talks on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. And if you found this podcast helpful, why not share it with a friend or coworker to help us spread automation awesomeness? And that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.